where are you right? You're still traveling, right? So where are you right now?
I'm filming an episode of United Shades of America in your hometown of San Diego, California. They First miss of you.
All, not my hometown. Secondly, they miss you. How the tables have turned.
From Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kundabolu, and I haven't slept in days because I have a baby.
I have no sympathy at all. We're two friends and stand-up comics trying to make sense of American politics.
That requires a lot of creativity, which we don't always have.
Because we don't get a lot of sleep, because kids.
Correct.
Our guest today is someone who actually does love to try to make sense of things, and he does it creatively.
David Diggs. He originated the roles of Thomas Jefferson and the Marquis de Lafayette in Hamilton.
Along with his friend Raphael Casal, he wrote and directed and starred in the film Blindspotting.
He portrays Frederick Douglass in the miniseries The Good Lord Bird, and he's going to play Sebastian in the Little Mermaid remake. And he's an MC!
And somehow he managed to release a rap song about Hanukkah. We talked to David about the imprint left on him by coming of age in the Bay Area.
All we did in high school was walk out. I don't remember any school, but I remember fucking marching.
And about the exhaustion he feels as an artist trying to find new ways to raise people's awareness about things we all should be aware of by now.
70 million people just voted for Trump, so like there's a lot of things that probably bear repeating.
And for some reason, we ended up talking about this.
My mom has a bidet, too, so...
What, for real?
Yeah.
We get personal, and political, and reactive with David Diggs.
Coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Kamau. Hello. How are you?
I'm good. I was going to say I'm good. I'm not really good. I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay.
Okay is the new good.
So I've been traveling around doing the show. This is the sixth episode we've taped since August. You know, you'll watch the show when it comes out in a few months, and you'll be able to tell that we film now because there's masks occasionally and there's talk of COVID. But I feel like there's a whole other show just about me and my blood pressure as I travel around the world. Just like, whoo. Sometimes I have to like take a walk just because it's like just watching people seem to not care as the numbers pile up is pretty frustrating. But hopefully, we're turning the corner. I just invented a vaccine. You're hearing about it being distributed around the country right now.
Yeah, the W. Kamau vaccine.
No, but the vaccine is now, as we sit here today, today was the first day that it was that it's been distributed to all 50 states and Puerto Rico. Because I'm black, as you know, I told you shortly after we met.
Yep.
There's a lot of talk about how black people are nervous around the vaccine, which, let me be clear, I get that 1,000%. I understand. Apparently, it's like only 55% of black people are interested in the vaccine, some sort of low percentage. But I get why black people would be suspicious of the government saying, here, we have something we'd like to give you a shot and put this in your system. I get that. It's also just frustrating because it's the government's fault that that happened. And yet, we need to take the vaccine.
The first wave of the vaccines, what, like government people and essential workers? Is that right?
Is it government? I mean, I'm sure the government people are going to get it, but I know it's
medical people for sure.
It's medical. It's medical people first. It's medical people and older people are the first wave.
So when do comedians get it?
I don't know, but I just want to say to all the people listening, to all the black folks listening, I will be first in line. So if you trust me, then get the vaccine. I just have this. I get why black people are nervous about it. I also feel like there are enough trusted medical professionals out there who are in the press. We've talked to Dr. Hotez here, and you know, I trust Anthony Fauci. I trust Sanjay Gupta. There's other medical people out there who I trust. I feel like if they say it's okay, I'm just going to go ahead and trust it that it's okay. And also my own doctor, who I trust. You know, like, so I don't assume that I'll go to my doctor Jess and be like, "Hey, can I get that vaccine?" And he's like, "Hold on a second, let me go get you the black vaccine." I don't think that's going to happen. I have to trust.
Well, I'm taking that vaccine as soon as possible. Whether that means I'll unretire from stand-up comedy, still up in the air. Did you know that I retired in my head?
Oh, you've accepted retirement?
I kind of like, it's funny. I thought I would miss it more, but over the last, maybe it's because not like other comics aren't performing too, so there's nothing I'm really missing out on.
You're not really jealous of comics out there who are doing Zoom comedy shows and comedy
right.
shows.
Or traveling outdoors. To the middle of the country to perform in front of 40 people spread out in a room.
Or in front of 100 people not spread out in a room because some clubs don't give a shit.
Not interested. Imagine bombing and that happened. Like, that's even...
Yes, yes.
Imagine bombing and, oh yeah, 3 people died because of your negligence. So, but yeah, I think... I don't miss it as much when the vaccine... Maybe I'll reconsider post-vaccine, but right now I'm like, I think I'm going to go back on the road at some point, but also maybe I'll wait till my kid graduates high school.
Nice. And then it'll be like, it'll be more fun. It'll be like a comeback. It'll be like on a comeback tour. It'll be more fun for the audience. I have to admit, like, I do, like, every now and again, I have thoughts in my head that I'm like, oh, that'd be a funny joke. But I really wasn't doing a lot of stand-up before COVID because Asha was born. And so... every now and again, I'd be like, oh, it'd be fun to do stand-up comedy. And then every now and again, I have an idea of, like, maybe I'll do that. Like, I'll get a outside show together, and maybe I'll do something in a park in Oakland. And then two things happen. One, first of all, it would suck if somebody came to that show, got COVID, and died. I'd feel sad about that. And also, I don't have any time for that for the same reasons before. Like, I got 3 kids, and I'm trying to save democracy. I really feel like this thing, like, it just feels, like, extra right now. Like, I feel like...
Yeah.
Maybe after the Georgia runoff, I'll see. And then you go, well, then what's after the Georgia runoff? Then we got to put pressure on Biden and to do the things that we believe he should do. Then we got the midterms. And then we got the re-election in 2020, we got the election in 2024. I don't know. It feels like, I don't know, somehow I don't even know if I'll have space to do stand-up comedy because this saving democracy thing is a lot more work than I anticipated.
And if you end up saving democracy and fixing the problems of the country, what the hell are you going to talk about in your stand-up anyway?
So here's the thing that happened. The Intercept has a podcast called Deconstructed, and it came across my social media feed.
And we should say that The Intercept is published by an affiliate of First Look Media, which is Topic Studios' parent company, and that Topic Studios produces Politically Reactive.
So apparently last week, President-elect Joe Biden had a Zoom call with many black political leaders around the country. And it was a Zoom call to sort of connect and to talk about things. And The Intercept, it's great because when you listen to the podcast, you can hear somebody on the call say, just to be clear about this, this is not to be released to the public. It's just for our own personal blah, 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 blah. And then Ryan Grimm from The Intercept goes, well, clearly we got it. So, and it is, and I encourage people to go listen to it. It's about 15 minutes long. It's not the Zoom call. It's sort of parts of the Zoom call for the audio from the Zoom call, and then Ryan Grimm commenting on it and sort of talking through what the Zoom call was about. And it's not inspiring. It feels like Joe Biden sort of like saying, "Be calm. We're not going to do all the things you want to do. We're going to do it eventually." But we're not going to do all those things. He's basically saying he's not going to use executive orders the way Trump has used them because there's a Constitution and we have to respect it. And it's him saying, basically, somebody asks him about naming Shirley Sherrod to a high position in his administration, and he somehow takes that as an opportunity to say, stop saying defund the police. We can't. That's how we lost the elections. And I got really frustrated with it, and I tweeted out a link to the podcast. And basically said Joe Biden was white-splaining to all these black folks.
It's almost like we elected Joe Biden president.
Yeah.
it's almost like that.
And so I was just super frustrated about it. And then I got some pushback from people who were like, somebody tweeted to me like, I guess we should have just re-elected Trump then, as if... You know, he's not. Some people who are like, he's not even in office yet, and we're already complaining about him.
Yeah, first of all, you can't use that excuse now that Biden got elected. Like, people were saying that shit before Biden got elected. Like, no, Trump's going to get elected if you keep seeing that. Now that Biden won, well, it's like going back in time, and then no, it's done. You can't keep throwing that in our face. It's done. You hold people accountable now.
I truly believe that if we are going to hold Biden's feet to the fire, we have to start as soon as possible. And a big part of that is constantly reminding him, the part that was frustrating about him doing this to these black folks is that black people literally saved your ass.
Yes.
James Clyburn saved you in South Carolina. He said, all right, black folks, I know we're not excited, but we need to get Joe. We need to bring the primary to Joe. Okay, fine. And then black folks and also indigenous folks and Latinx folks, I'm thinking specifically about Arizona, but you talk about Georgia, Pennsylvania, those are the people who said, all right, we're gonna bring those states to you, Joe. I mean, again, we've talked about this before, but the fact that the Democrats won Georgia, that wasn't on the strength of believing in Biden. That was on the strength of black activists in Georgia going, we need to do this. But guess what? Now we have receipts, President-elect Joe Biden, and you have to respect those receipts. Republicans always drive it like they stole it, and Democrats drive it like it was rented and they forgot to get the insurance. I just feel like I wish there was some more of that, like, now that we're in here, let's really do some things. The great thing about Deconstructed, they also had a podcast about here's things Joe Biden could do even if he does not have those Senate seats.
Right.
So I would advise people to check out the Deconstructed podcast. And one of those things is like the student debt thing. He could do that on day one. If you wiped out American student debt, most people would be like, finally, in this one way, I'm back to zero. like all the money I was putting into that, I can now put into something else. Or all the money I was avoiding paying, I can now relax and not be afraid of when they come knocking at my door.
He has the audacity on this tape to basically say, trust me, we're going to get to it. Trust me. It's like, why? Why should we trust you exactly? Like 46 years and look that you've been in an office in some way and look at where we are still.
Yeah.
So trust you? You can't base this on trust.
Because even I think about like the defund the police thing. In the time that we've had like this argument about defund the police in the last few weeks, Casey Goodson died to a black man entering into his house in front of his grandmother and his five-year-old brother. And even the black man who was killed on death row, Brandon Bernard, who was killed on death row. We are killing black people. While we're talking about defund the police is too aggressive and too scary. It just, to me, it's just like, it just really, it's super depressing. And I really don't have any patience for people who are saying things like, we have to wait or we have to give them a chance. We did all this work to get you elected. And now you're on our schedule. You're on our clock.
It's older white people
who. You're going ageist again.
It's older white. I mean, I'm trying to think. Is it ageist? is it? Well, no. I mean, it's a description. It's older white people who, you know, if it was their kids or their grandkids, would act. Mm-hmm. But the idea that these are black people, you know, who they expect will vote for them. And at the same time, like, they're not connected to communities. They're not connected to what's happening. They have no personal stake in it. Mm-hmm. They have no personal connection to it. And they're also so disconnected from the populations they represent because they've been in Washington so long. Like, this doesn't register. This, to them, is like any other issue. Mm. It's the murder of a part of our population by the government. And to them, it's like, we'll get to those potholes when we get to it. And that's not what it is, but they just don't feel it. If you feel something in your gut, you act.
I think it's establishment white folks. It's also white folks of privilege, which is what Joe Biden is. Like, whether he's, no matter what his age is, he's certainly a white man who has lived in privilege for a long, long time.
Right.
And when you say things like, be patient, what you're basically saying is, it's not going to affect me. If the police don't get defunded, I'll be fine. And everybody I know will be fine. And probably most of the people, everybody on the call, all these black people will be fine because you're not, you feel like you guys are all going to be fine. I'll be fine. To me, it's just, it's such a statement of immense privilege and not being clear about how you got the job in the first place. Biden got, what, over 80 million votes.
Yeah.
And that's not all a referendum on Joe Biden. That was a referendum on Trump and saying, basically, Biden, we will loan you this support.
Yeah,
but then we're going to come asking for a payment because it'll be due. Now that we've loaned you that support, this is like you owe us something. And I think we have to be clear about that. And if you're not clear about that, I really don't have any time for you telling me that now is not the time to criticize a president or a president-elect of the United States of America. There are literally lives at stake.
When's the time?
I just don't have time.
Because these old white people have been talking about, like, it's not the time, it's not the time, like... Yeah, you're gonna be dead, and you're still gonna be saying that to your grave. It's not the time.
Yeah.
Like, it's enough. And there's a generation that's growing up and that's seeing this, and it's, you know, you will get. I really believe you're gonna get, you know, voted out. You know, you can say defund the police, like we can't, you know, the language, whatever, then, okay, reframe it. Mm-hmm. Don't use the words defund the police, but think about the actual choices, because Biden's still talking about reform. We'll just throw more money on it. We'll get psychologists. We'll just give them more money. How much more money do the police need exactly? They've been getting a lot of money.
If you look at most city budgets, I don't think they got in many places they have half the city budget or more.
If you're going to throw money at something, don't throw money at the police. That's not going to it's also really strange. It almost feels like you're like, you killed all these innocent people. So what are you going to do about it? We're going to give you a ton of money. Like there's something
Do you need more money? And I think connected to this, to me, when I think about like why we cannot be patient, is because is sort of the example of that is these 126 Republicans in Congress, who were basically it was like a civil war. Would you mind if we overturned the rule of democracy? Like 126 Republicans who signed on because they wanted Trump to win the election, that we should overturn election results.
For years, I've talked about American democracy with our noses up in the air and with a certain type of moral superiority. And we've looked down in other countries, whether they're in Africa or Asia or South America, as, you know, look at these countries that can't get their shit in order, can't get their, there's so much corruption. And since Trump was elected, you see more clearly than ever, this has nothing to do with capability. It has nothing to do with moral fortitude and what we have that other countries don't have in terms of our values. This has to do with money, right? Because if we were a developing country, like we're clearly showing all the things that lead to either a coup or a civil war, right? This country, like the idea that they want to overturn an election, if this was happening in another country, we would have stepped in.
Yeah.
This money is allowing us to avoid civil war, because if we didn't have the money that we have, if we didn't have the military we have, there would have been multiple civil wars, and this would be four or five different countries. The only thing that keeps this country together is money. That is the only thing. It's wealth. There is nothing else that could keep this country. It's a good, it's a deal with the devil, right? It's a good deal, because I will get these basic needs met because I'm in America. But if we didn't have the money, what is the incentive to stick around?
We should not forget who these people are. We should not go. It should not be after Joe Biden's elected that we just go, anyway, back to regular. And that's the thing that frustrates me, is that COVID has shown we should not go back to normal. And this, it does not make sense to me that we would let these 126 Republicans get away with this, and a bunch of red state attorneys general were a part of this too, and not hold them accountable. People have said Nancy Pelosi could refuse to seat them when the new Congress starts. That would be great. I don't know that that's going to happen, but I do believe that, like, we can't just let traitors trait. Traitors going to trait. We can't just let that pass. Anyway, luckily, today's show, although there is big talk in this show, our guest today is like a total breath of fresh air and beloved by all, David Diggs.
Oh, he's so one of the most talented human beings I've ever met. Also incredibly kind.
You know him from Hamilton, the movie Blindspotting. He's on Blackish. And in the midst of all this, after we recorded this, he had time to release a new song about Hanukkah. So like he's an unstoppable force for good in the universe. So yeah, I'm happy to have him on the show. And oops, I forgot to mention, and Oakland's own. So you know he's good.
David Diggs is an actor, rapper, writer, and a director.
You know him as the Marquis de Lafayette in Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton, and he also wrote, produced, and starred in the 2018 film Blindspotting, which he and Rafael Casal are now developing as a TV series.
Also, he's the MC for the experimental hip-hop group Clipping, which recently released its fourth album, Visions of Bodies Being Burned.
And this year, he played Frederick Douglass in the miniseries The Good Lord Bird, and he signed up to play Sebastian in Disney's remake of The Little Mermaid.
It's time to talk to David Diggs. Hey, David! Hey, man. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you, guys. Yeah.
You're one of the most talented people we've had on here, because you write, and you act, and you rap, and you're an activist,
You already have a Grammy and a Tony. In your mind, do you ever think, oh, I'm going to get this EGOT? Like, I'm just too away from this EGOT.
Nah. That Grammy and that Tony were accidental. So it's not, you know what I'm saying? I wasn't, I don't have a solid plan on how I would get those things, you know?
Right.
No, I don't think about it at all. I'm just sort of happy to have jobs that I like, you know? Like, that's the cool part. Like, the awards don't, you know, like they didn't mean it. I don't know where either of them are. You know what I'm saying? Like those trophies. Like the Grammy was like our fourth shot glass for a while, but then I lost it. So I don't know where, like, I don't know where this shit is. They don't do anything, you know? and it didn't
That's
change
so weird because
my life
when
really
I,
that much. So
when I got the, Emmy, Hurry, I have an Emmy, for, I have three actually, Hurry.
I know. I've seen the pictures of your three Emmys. Yes.
I really felt like it was like it was like a 1 year extension in show business.
Yeah, no, it feels like everybody wants to talk to you about that for a while, but still nobody wants to talk to you about your ideas.
Well, luckily I don't have to deal with that problem because I don't have any of that hardware. Yeah, so it's all ideas for me.
Yeah, no, you're
winning. People are only concerned with what I'm thinking.
I've talked to you several times throughout this pandemic, and every time I talk to you, you're in a different city, like either quarantining or coming off quarantine. What is it like to be actually out in the world doing this work in the midst of all this coronavirus and everything?
It's pretty shitty. I mean, like, it's dope. You know, it's dope that we are figuring out ways to work in this industry that, like, employs a ton of people who aren't us, right? Who aren't actors. Like, we're on the blind spotting set right now and having all these conversations. You know, so many shows in the US are getting shut down because COVID's running through the productions and everything. And we've got, you know, a great COVID team in place and everybody's being very careful, but we keep having to, or feeling like we need to re-up the conversation, in particular with the actors who are sort of like the highest paid people in the building. And the only people who walk around without masks ever, right? Because you have to. So, like, if it comes into the building, you probably did it, you know? And so, and there's 250 other people who's like have jobs for the first time in 6 months who are so excited to just be working and building our fucking sets and hanging our lights and doing all these things to make everybody in the show look and sound beautiful. And that's I am very proud to be able to create job opportunities right now. But then also it makes me incredibly nervous because I also don't want to be the one to fuck it up because I, like, couldn't live without that last Whole Foods trip or some shit.
No, I feel the same way where I'm out filming United Shades right now. And it is weird to sort of, as you hear all this essential worker talk and people who haven't worked in months, to be like, how am I an essential worker? Why is it important that I'm doing this, you know?
Right before everything locked down, we had just started, like, remodeling our kitchen, you know? And then everything shut down. We're like, yeah, but does this count as essential? It is construction, right? And they were like, yeah. We can send one person at a time. So people kept coming to work on our house. And I was like, this is just rich people loopholes. That's all that is. This isn't definitely, like, painting my kitchen green is not essential, but I'm happy that I could pay somebody to do it.
My dad had a bidet installed in the house during COVID times.
Essential.
And it's true, yeah. And I just remember thinking, first of all, like, a bidet? Like, what level of income do you think we have? You are retired also, so maybe we don't have bidet money just lying around. And also, who installs a bidet?
Yeah.
In Queens.
Where did you get it? Yeah, is what, where'd you find that person?
It's probably another Indian dude. That's kind of how my dad functions generally, except there's one Irish dude, Dennis, that he's known forever. Everybody is just some Indian dude, and you just have to make sure it's in the community, you know? So you just keep it in the community, and we always get overcharged. Something always breaks because their main qualification wasn't like plumber or, you know, somebody who builds driveways, it's like, oh, you guys are Indian and you have a truck.
Yeah. My mom has a bidet too. So.
What? For real? Yeah. Wait, what? Really?
Yeah. For years. Had one for a long time.
Wow, man.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, in some ways it's consistent because, like, you know, Indians, I don't know if this is very personal. I don't know if we've ever gotten into this,
Kamal. I know we're really getting into some deep dive bidet talk.
But, you know, Indians, we the whole toilet paper concept, we're all about washing.
Yeah.
Like, we have something called a lota, and, like, you have, like, you put water in it, and you actually clean yourself. And that's why there's always this belief that, like, it's weird that white people think we're dirty, because I'm like, I don't know. Because you guys, like, white people don't use washcloths or water to clean their butts. So it's just like, are we dirty? Yeah. Are brown people dirty, really? It's consistent with my father's belief system in terms of, like, finally we have the ability to properly clean our butts. Yeah. This was a turn we didn't expect.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out how to segue back into, so, you're on the set of Blindspot.
Well, I have a question about you playing Frederick Douglass in Good Lord Bird. Yeah. Since there's no archival stuff, right? Like, there's no archival stuff of his audio.
Yeah.
Like, you don't know what he sounded like. So is that more freedom? Because you can kind of do whatever you want. Because, like, I remember when Chadwick Boseman played Jackie Robinson, mm-hmm. it's an incredible portrayal, except Jackie Robinson had a very high-pitched voice,
yeah.
which actually sounds kind of comical. So, like, you had to play him with a deeper voice. But there's no record for Frederick Douglass. So, I mean, how did you actually come up with it?
Well, I tracked down one very scratchy piece of audio that claimed to be a recording of Frederick Douglass. I don't know if it was or not. It would have, you know, it would have had to have been something that was preserved from, like, recording through a phonograph into one of those huge pieces of wax. And, like, it sounded like it was, but also who knows? But it was enough to give me just an idea of something to play with, you know? And between that and just reading his speeches and reading people's reactions to his speeches, you know, like, that was, it was more of that than the, I think I listened to that audio once and was like, I don't know, this probably isn't real, so I don't need it. But there's a lot of talk about the fullness of his voice, and obviously, like, he writes in this tone that sounds like you should be talking like this, you know? So, yeah, today he'd be selling Allstate, but in the day.
You're really in good hands with Frederick Douglass.
Yeah. It was freeing in some senses. I mean, that also McBride's take on Frederick Douglass is pretty freeing of everything. He immediately gives you permission to, like, take any hangups you might have about, like, trying to wear, like, kid gloves with this character, because he is both, like, incredibly important and is ridiculous in this story. And that's why I said yes. So I've been asked, believe it or not, I've been asked to play Frederick Douglass before.
I believe that.
Now you've got the hair for it.
Like, yeah.
Sort of what happens.
I've just been asked to do the hair part, not the acting part.
And I've said no every time because I don't really, like, it felt too important. And therefore, like, particularly unimportant, because who cares? But then this take on him was like, oh, this is fun. And he still opens his episode giving the 4th of July speech. Just like, fuck, I get to do both of those things? That's crazy.
Well, speaking of that 4th of July speech, I would say collaborated, but a bunch of people worked on that, the new take on the 4th of July speech through our friend Adam Mansbach, who... really powerful, like it was a bunch of different writers and activists and artists who all just wrote a bunch of stuff, and then I guess Adam remixed it and then you performed it.
What to my people is the 4th of July? Police parade down streets, proud descendants of the slave patrol in the theater of denial, a propaganda pageant, and we are on the front lines. All summer my uncle can't sleep, and he was born free, and he ain't never been.
When Adam asked me to do it, I was like, yes, I will sit down and write some words for this, but I'm kind of busy. And then I saw the thing when I was like, wow. And I think I got an in, which I was pretty happy about.
Yeah, I had a similar response when I saw the list of writers, and it was like all of my favorite people. And I was just like, yeah, I mean, yeah, I'll do that. They were like, you could write something if you want. I was like, no, I think I'm good. I think they got it.
So you just want to bring that up to say you clearly, and you know, you can connect this to what it's like, how this comes from being from the Bay, but there's no question that you have a political cultural viewpoint. You were getting out the vote. You did the thing with Fairyland that I was also involved in to save Fairyland, which is an amazing place that that people would be lucky to be at someday again. You're one of people is like, this is, you just so are the Bay, and that sort of template of how people from the Bay are like, you can't just be out there trying to make money. You have to say something and help some people.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we don't know how to make art any other way, right? That's how we all came up, like being artists who were political, you know. I'd all we did in high school was walk out. I don't remember any school, but I remember fucking marching quite a bit. And so it's just part of the way I respond to art. And all of the people who were my mentors growing up, you know, folks like Mark Bamuthi Joseph and these incredible sort of artist activists who they are the same thing. There's a sort of a purpose to creating something, even when it's silly. You want to at least point at something. And you both of y'all's comedy is like this too. You know, comedy is one of those things that being in on the joke is a political act, right? Mm-hmm. You have to understand the premise in order to get the joke. And so that's why I'm such a big fan of y'all's too. It's just that like the work is inherently political, and that is what makes it funny. If you don't understand the politics of it, then you don't get the joke.
Yeah.
Right. And also I think but that also creates an opportunity of like, I want to understand the joke, so let me figure out the politics. Right,
exactly. Yeah, it creates culture around shared political beliefs, or even just discussion about political issues or about issues that affect real people. And that's, I think, you know, I'm not gonna write policy or something, you know, I'm not gonna argue in front of the Senate, I hope. But, but like, if I can make something that makes anybody look at it and think about it again, right? Like, this real value of art is actually kind of in the replay value a lot of times, right? It's like to see something one time and be like, oh, wait a minute, and go back and see it again, and have to actually sit down and think about something, you know, that's what the whole blind spotting experiment has been. And that's, I try to be part of pieces like that are so entertaining that you want to watch them again or experience them again, and then also upon have enough layers that it will force you to continue to dive into the issue. And like, I didn't know shit about John Brown before I did Lord Byrd, you know? And that feels very intentional on the part of the American education system, right? Like, why, I don't know, why would you teach young Americans that like an uprising by a few like poorly armed people could cripple the country? Like, that's actually not a thing you would teach your population, I think, if you're trying to maintain the status quo. So those things are interesting to me.
Also encouraging white people to pick up guns to protect black people.
Right.
That is a revolutionary idea.
Totally.
I feel like the anti-racist piece is the part that feels key to me. We'll talk about white people picking up guns, but you know.
Yeah. Pick up guns and hand them out to black people.
Yeah. That's where social studies class gets a little like, ah.
I don't know. Yeah.
You mentioned blind spotting. I love blind spotting. And you and Rafa Casal created this wonderful thing. And it's just absolutely, it's smart. It's funny. I mean, the editing style, the depth of the characters. It's an incredible piece about friendship, about gentrification, about race, politics, police brutality. Like, it's all in there. Were there things you were trying to actively avoid, like traps? You're like, we're going to tell this story about the Bay, about this friendship, about gentrification, but we're not going to go down this road. We're going to avoid that trope. Were there things you were intentionally trying to avoid?
I think it was just trying to maintain the tone. When we settled on this idea, it really helped lock it in. This idea that it is a comedy in a world that won't let it be one. So these two guys really just want to be in a buddy comedy. And that's always what they're putting towards. but it's still at the time, right, like 2017 United States, like it just won't let it happen. And I think that was sort of the guiding principle for us, and not wanting to allow anything to be too precious. So, you know, one of the oldest things in that script is that verse moment at the end where I'm just like rapping at waving a gun at a cop. And we had to justify that somehow throughout the film because we really liked that moment. And it was, in fact, the thesis of the movie. But like, we didn't want it to feel like you were supposed to snap afterwards or something, you know, slam poetry shit. And so it became like a game of making sure that the tone always was trying to find the humor in the scene, even when the scene wasn't funny. If there was a moment for humor, we had to find it. And then also setting up the verse in ways all the way throughout the movie. And that's the thing I'm sort of the most proud of about it is that, you know, early on we see them freestyle with each other. And there's one other instance where they're sort of actively, where they're clearly like speaking in verse intentionally, but there are all kinds of like verse layered throughout that film. That whole, the whole scene in the hair salon is also written in verse, and the whole, it's all like sort of subtly layered in there to try and train people's ears to when this thing comes at them by the end, like to not just be like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, right, right, right.
And so, and I think that was, among many things I'm proud of about that movie, like that's kind of the thing I'm most proud of, because nobody told us how to do that. We didn't know how to do that. We just sort of had an idea that this might work, and it did, I thought.
Yeah, no, it did. It did. I mean, it has that feeling as somebody who lives in the Bay and lives in the East Bay, and but also I'm always want to remind myself, I'm not from here, so don't act too like like when I hear the word transplant in that movie, I'm like, ah, that might be me. You know?
I don't know. You've been there quite a while.
I've been here quite a while. But like the thing that I really loved about it is that it did feel like Oakland. You know what I mean? Like, and I had never seen that on screen before, even from the opening credits. You just suddenly feel this, like, you know, seeing it in the Bay Area, like you get this Bay Area pride comes through. Were there other movies that had featured the Bay or other TV shows that you were inspired by? Because it felt very much the same way that, like, if you're late 90s or like I would say early 90s New York, you watch a Spike Lee movie, even if you're from New York, you go, I think I get it now. You know what I mean? Like, you know.
Yeah, that's what we wanted to do, because we didn't feel like we had that ever either, to like a thing that was like, it's like this, that like that you could point to and be like, oh, Oakland.
Yeah.
You know? You don't think Full House gave an accurate depiction of the Bay?
I don't think they nailed it, but also I never lived in that neighborhood, so.
Right.
But what was it like? What was that show that was set in Berkeley? Parenthood or something?
Yeah. Like
the least Berkeley thing I've ever seen. I don't know. Like, I live in Sherman Oaks now, and that's where that show is set.
Well, it's like whenever I see King of Queens, I'm like, really?
Really?
White dude? Really? The King of Queens is Indian. He sells kebabs in Jackson Heights. Like, what are you talking about? Kevin James is the king?
That's the weird thing about having a show that's like, or any piece of content that's like really about a place where you're from, and it's so not that. And it's this like kind of thing where it's like equal parts like anger about just like, how dare you disrespect me, but then also is that how you think I am?
Is that how like, you see me?
What am I doing wrong? Like, how did I manage to present that?
Well, one thing I think about with especially Oakland right now is with the pandemic and the hit on the economy, like when you go out, and I don't go out that often because I'm trying to not catch this COVID, but you start to see businesses closing that have been around for a long time. And some people have said, like, what's going to happen? And, you know, and also you hear all these tech people are starting to go, oh, I can do this from my ranch in Idaho. I don't have to be here anymore. So it's like, well, that's kind of good, I think, that they're leaving. But also when you see the businesses that longtime businesses owned by Black people or lots of people closing, I just sort of am really wondering, like, if like what's about to happen? Do you have thoughts on that? Like, it's about to change in a real dramatic way.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't. No, but I do think site-specific art is in the only ways that like I know how to help is tends to be helpful, because it makes a thing real. I mean, that was the whole hype with Fairyland, right?
Hold up, wait a minute.
So what is this children's fairyland you and David keep going on about?
Children's Fairyland is a magical place. It's an Oakland institution, and it's right next to Lake Merritt in downtown Oakland, and it's been there since 1950. It was one of the first themed amusement parks in the country, and it hasn't changed a lot over the years, which you can tell, but that also makes it kind of awesome. It's got puppet shows and nursery rhyme themed buildings, and if you have a kid there, I'd say especially from the ages of like 0 to about like 7 or 8 or 9, it is just a fun place to explore and run around and have a good time. And it's one of the amusement parks that Walt Disney looked at when he was looking at ideas for Disneyland. And you can kind of tell when you're at Fairyland that, yeah, Walt Disney was like, yeah, I can see doing this. Let's just do it bigger and more. And he hired the first director of Fairyland, Dorothy Maines, to be Disneyland's youth director. And unlike Disneyland and most other amusement parks, where you go and you take your family there and you got to take out like a loan or remortgage your house, it is not a huge money-making operation. Admission is just $12. And these days, it actually runs as a nonprofit. And most importantly, it is really for kids. If you're an adult, you cannot be there unless you bring a child with you. Fairyland is amazing. I love you. Thank you for all the good times, Fairyland. And we'll be back once that vaccine comes out.
We blasted out just how wonderful Fairyland is all over the place. And we got money in from all over the world, not just from folks in Oakland, because we were able to show that it is important to keep this place alive, even if it's not in your community. These kinds of places are worth supporting. And then also re-up on the community support of this place, being like, remember, this is right here. And maybe you grew up going to it and you forgot that it's here, or like you don't have kids yet, so you can't come or something. But like, just things about real people in real places, I think, are, as far as what artists can do, I find that stuff really helpful to just remind people we're here and we need help. You know, yeah. Like we need to help each other.
There was a New York Times piece that you did. You'd made this statement about like people are asking you to say, can you talk about this? Can you talk about that? And it's stuff that's already been in your work that you've talked about 10 or 15 years now. And I related to that just because I made that Apu documentary a few years ago. And people, you know, some people loved it, some people hated it. But for me, it was like, this is old.
Right.
I don't really want to be talking about this now. I feel like a responsibility to like close it and make this thing. But like, and the experience of making a thing is cool and I'm learning from that. But the actual substance I find boring. Do you feel like you're at a place now that you don't need to address certain things constantly? Because of course your life experience is so much richer and broader. And also, what are those things? What are the things that are in your brain? Like, I want to talk about this. I want to make something about that.
Look, 70 million people have just voted for Trump. So like, I think like there's a lot of things that probably bear repeating. I think I am interested in figuring out new and interesting ways to try and hammer points home, right? So like that's, you know, that was, again, like Good Lord Bird is a good example of that. Like there's not I've never read anything like that. But like a lot of the points that it's making are not new, but they do need to be heard still. And so that's what we're trying to do, is like figure out different ways to have people hear things. You know, the point of frustration for me at that moment when George Floyd was murdered was like, Blindspotting took us 10 years to write, and it was inspired by the exact same incident, right? Mm-hmm. That happened 10 years prior. Oscar Grant was murdered at Fruitvale Bar Station. Like that's why we wrote Blindspotting. That is, you know, we've been shouting this same thing for 10 years, and all of us are still shouting these things. And so it does get frustrating when they continue to happen and nobody hears them. And the thing about Oscar Grant was that we thought was different was that there were 100 different angles of that happening. It was all caught on video by everybody on that bar train, just watched a police officer shoot a kid who was handcuffed face down on the ground. So we knew, and I was living 3 blocks away at the time, and we knew this was finally going to show the world that this is what happens. And that was 10 years ago. And like, people still don't believe it. Still like, you know, and so for those of us who are, you know, who can't seem to separate our politics from our art, I think it feels like it's about finding ways that frustration is part of the storytelling. We can't ignore that. I can't keep pretending like it's new. You know, I'm not teaching a kindergarten class. Like, I'm not talking to children. I'm speaking to like grownups who also live in the world. And so I think like that's the tricky part for me, is sort of ignoring the elements of frustration that are there. And that's what I'm trying to avoid in my work these days. It's like, how can I say things that acknowledge the fact that I'm exhausted?
Say it again. Can you say it again? Can you look into the mirror and then say it?
Clipping's been around for 10 years, and obviously since the beginning of when you started clipping and to now, like, you've done a ton of things. Why is this something that you still do? Because obviously you have a ton of projects already.
You know, it's the only, I can't get that fix anywhere else. There's no way that the way that we make music, that we've stumbled on this thing that is, it's so clear when a clipping song is done, because it's when the three of us say it's finished. Like it is, the way we work is so specific. It only works for us. It's actually really hard for us to work with features. Like we love doing it, but we basically have to come up with the whole framing narrative for why this person is on this song and build the whole song around them. So send them something, have an idea, send them something, have them send something back, and then remake the whole song around what they did, because it's not fair to ask anybody else to work like we do. It's so rare to feel like you have that much control over a piece of art that you make. Like if a clipping song comes out, we love that song and it's exactly what we wanted to do. Like no one ever forces us to put something out before it's ready or like anything like that. We just like, it is, that thing is what we were trying to make. That's really gratifying, and I don't get that anywhere else. Or more like secret on country, or contrary, more like skin on teeth, thin veil, don't tell what it don't see. Many, many things are multiplying at the bottom where the base of everything is from. Hot, hit the core, work on the floor, don't stop till the strong enough to hold the horse. Oh, air is heavy, you wet, sweat, drown. Nobody better make a sound. Break it down, break it down. And anything else I do, like the art is in the compromise, right? Is in the, oh, well, I can't do this, and that showed me this other thing that I could do. But clipping isn't that. It's, we set out to do an exact thing and then we do that exact thing. And it's the only place in my life where that happens. So.
I think that's why a lot of stand-ups, despite how successful they get after, keep stand-up in their life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really the only place where no one can tell you what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can make the choice. And, you know, you are the editor, the creator. Like, everything is in your control. I mean, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah, totally.
The one place where you can do what you want.
And I like working with those guys. But yeah, you know, we're making this TV show now, and like every day we're confronted with like, well, you can't afford that. But I mean, it's what I wrote. What do you mean? So we're in an impasse here. Do I have to rewrite something, or do you have to find more money? Oh, I have to rewrite. Right. Okay.
It's like, they're like, we're,
it's always that.
They're like,
it's,
we're not in an impasse here, sir. You. I'm passing this on to you.
Right.
Well, talk about a little bit the thing you were just saying about the earlier about the parenthood style of like where it's the Bay, but it's not really the Bay because it's Santa Monica and they don't even come to film exteriors up here or anything. And you're making this show, as you said, in not the Bay.
All of the concessions I have made to budget are to add budget to what we're shooting in the Bay. So like it's very important to us to get as much as we can shot up there, not just for the locations, although the locations are very important. We want to be able to see it, but also we've got a great cast and we've cast some folks from there. And obviously like Rafa and I are helming it. And like, there's a lot of Bay down here. Like this, our lighting crew is the same crew that worked on Blindspotting. Like we have brought as much of the vibe down as we can, but you know, we can't cast background from the Bay to shoot in scenes we shoot down here like that. And that's the stuff that you can't write that. And every time, you know, the folks like our director, Seth Mann, who's amazing, hasn't spent for the pilot, who's he's incredible, hadn't spent a ton of time up there and like went on a scouting trip to look at the parts of his episodes that are going to be shot up there. And he came back and was like, we have to shoot the whole thing up there. You can't fake this. That's what we've been saying, Brett. Like, I know, but we're going to fake it. So trying to be really smart. And obviously, like the interiors, we can, you know, we're recreating Marcus Books on our soundstage.
Oh,
like
it's
cool. Like so much more is possible than I thought, because this is the thing about indie films is you never make anything. What you use is like the choice to have that beautiful blue wall in your film. I didn't choose that blue wall. Like, it was the wall. We didn't paint it blue, you know, like that. We couldn't afford to do that. Like, there's so much more money in these TV shows, and you can make a choice and then make that thing happen. But it's hard to switch your brain to that, because I've never worked like that before. So it's a steep learning curve. But I think we're gonna pull it off. I mean, I'm really excited. We start shooting tomorrow. Like, that's our first day of shooting.
How close is the movie to the show? Like, are there characters that are in both, or are you all gonna be in it at times, you and Rafa, or anybody else from the original cast, or like, what are the differences and similarities?
Yeah, so it's really following Ashley, so Jasmine Cephas-Jones' character. Emmy Award winning Jasmine Cephas-Jones.
Yeah, there we go.
Which happened this year, which is exciting. But she, yeah, you know, when we didn't really want to do this show, and Lionsgate was like, we should make a TV show. And we were like, nah. And they were like, no, well, let's like talk about it. And we were like, okay. So we go and have this meeting. We're sitting in this meeting. And we're like, look, there's no way. It doesn't work. The only way it would work is if we made it about Ashley, that'd be pretty cool, because we always wanted to spend more time with her in the film. We didn't really get to. So like, yeah, we could do that, but we don't, well, okay. And then like, Colin's not going, like, the incident's different, but maybe Miles went to, I don't know. Like, anyway, we just started like spinning on all of these things. And by the time we got out of the meeting, we were like, oh man, I guess we got to make this TV show. but one of the, it was mostly really exciting for us to get to spend more time with Ashley and to really make it her story. And so it was working out from there. And then the interesting thing about TV is like the multiple stories and perspectives that you get to tell, because you're coming back to it every week. So anyway, Jasmine Cephas-Jones is in it. Raphael is in it. I'm not in it really this season. I mean, you might catch a glimpse or something. but when my brother came off probation, finally, he just bounced. He was so sick of being in one place, and so stuck after, you know, after coming out of jail and then being on probation, whatever. And he just started walking. It felt like Colin would do that.
Yeah.
I actually couldn't see a way for us to get him in the show, even if I could. You know, it's also dangerous to put me in a show, because I'm committed to all these other shows, so it would fuck up the shoot schedule. But like, I actually couldn't see a good way to write Colin. He just pointed a gun at a cop. Like, he had to.
So it's probably time to.
You gotta have to, at least for a year or so. You gotta go somewhere. Yeah. So Colin left, but we spend time with Miles's family, and so we get to see all kinds of folks we haven't seen before, and I wish I could announce to you who else is playing everybody, but it's very exciting. Our cast is super lit. I don't know, it's a big swing for everybody. It's a big swing for us, a big swing for Stars. Like, we don't know, but why else do a thing? You know, what other reason is there to do a thing if you're not going to try to do it? So excited. We'll see. Maybe by the end of this week, I'll be like, we've made a horrible mistake. But so far, so good.
Does it feel like, I feel like I've been talking to a lot of people about this. It feels like America is really on a, like, which way are you going? You know what I mean? Like, are we the country that is about to like really sort of gut check itself and go, okay, we need to change everything. And so we're going to actually become the country that we've claimed that we taught our kids we were in social studies classes.
Or
are we about to go the other direction, where it's like, when people in other countries are like, remember when America was hot? Like, remember when that was like, where it's like a nightclub where it's like, man, I used to go to America all the time.
Yeah. That's, you know, it's funny. I talked to my dad, who like has a real sort of mixed relationship with voting and everything in general, you know, like, but has, you know, particularly as long as I've been able to vote, has sort of dragged himself to the polls to vote, but is sort of the mind that like, none of these people give a shit about me, and I don't really give a shit about them, you know? So like, that's kind of what it is. And I was talking to him after this one, and his ballot, he ended up having to vote again. His ballot got lost. Like, you know, he had to like track my ballot system, and he like dropped it in a little box, and then like the ballots from that box that day got lost, and they all got recent anyway.
Wow.
But he was just like, I don't really know what to say anymore. I just, y'all tell me what you're going to do. It's kind of like what it is. Tell me what you're doing, man. I'm clearly just here to roll with the punches. Like, and there is, that's part of the exhaustion, right? It's like, it does feel like that. Like, we're at this point where either we're going to work really, really hard. And that's the thing. Like, it's going to be fucking hard work to, like, become that model society we keep telling people we are. You know, like, that's a lot of work. And you got to decide. It's got to be, you have to decide you're going to do it. And I don't know. It does feel like that moment. But I definitely felt the same way as my pops. It was like, just let me know.
Just let me know. How does it feel to have somebody from Oakland in the no, somebody from Oakland's going to be in the White House?
I don't know what, I want to be careful about what I say because it's.
I know, it's a complicated, even when I asked it, I was like, this could go a lot of different ways.
I know. Look, here, ultimately, I am excited about Kamala. I think, like, she also, her administration is the one that locked my brother up. So it was hard for me to come around to that point, which is like, a long way for me to come around. And a lot of the policies that she has had over the course of her career are ones that I disagree with. I wasn't there. I wasn't watching her every move or anything. So I don't have a good sense of why she made a lot of the decisions that she made. And she is a politician. I think her beliefs, at least as I've been able to gather them, is to hear them in terms of like the direction she believes the country should go in align with mine. Mm-hmm. And I think she is smart. And that to me, and she believes in facts and science and things like that. You know, the bar is pretty low right now. But here's the thing, like, you can have a discussion with this person. And like, her opinion, whatever it is based in some sense of reality. And also, I think she does seem like a person who takes her responsibility to be a representative of people seriously. And so that's about as much as I could hope for, I think. and then, like, from a representation perspective, obviously, like, Kamala means a lot more, I think, having like a mixed woman from the Bay Area in showing that that is possible to a lot of people who didn't think it was possible is I think a good thing. I feel like a lot of folks from the Bay probably have mixed feelings about Kamala, but I ultimately am very excited. Actually, like, have come around to the point. I mean, when she was making her acceptance speech, I was teary eyed. Like, it got me. It got me.
We sometimes want to think we're too smart or too cynical, or we feel too jaded, and then there's those moments where you're like, no, I'm a human.
Yeah, and like I said, we're coming out of this time that feels so insane and unprecedented. I think, like, to a certain degree, and this is, you know, Biden's been on this hype too, like, you have to allow for the reset. You have to be like, that let's close this chapter. This is where we are starting from now. Mm-hmm. So let's start from right here. Here's where we are. And let's give everybody the opportunity to show who they are and to be themselves, you know? We keep expecting people to be superhuman, like, we'll never, then you just have figureheads and you don't have people that are actually doing the work. Like, you want somebody who is human, who has made things that they claim are mistakes and is able to say, that was a mistake that I made. I was wrong. And I am, like, working to make amends for that. Like, I am so quick to vote for somebody who will admit to a mistake. Like, my God, like, that's just like, or to being wrong about something like that, to be able to engage in conversation and have new information brought to you and realize that you were wrong about something. Like, all the rest of us have to do that every day. I have to say I'm sorry to my girlfriend like 20 times a day. You know, like, I'm wrong so much.
Yeah.
But we don't expect that of our politicians, or in fact, like, we, you know, having disagreements with them or being critical of them is not something you're allowed to do. I think we should all be way more critical and, like, also love them more. This is fun, guys.
Yeah, this is fun. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention in all of our Oakland talk that you're literally wearing a dope era Mr. Fab sweatshirt.
All day. All Oakland, all day, every day. Got an Oaklandish shirt under it. I don't, you know.
Oh, wow.
Pretty much only have Oakland things.
I've noticed that. But yeah, dope era specifically. That feels like real, like, a lot of people know Oaklandish, but Dope Era feels like a higher level, like a more inner
circle. Yeah, yeah, it's advanced level Oakland shit.
It's advanced level.
Yeah, shout out to Fabby Davis. We got buyers up in Oakland trying to, you know, wardrobe every outfit everywhere.
Oh, wow.
We ran up against this in the movie with a costume designer who we were working with, who was like, it's just not believable that everybody in the city would like wear things with the city's name on it. And I was like, where are you from? Like, you know, I don't know where you're from. Like, I don't, that is what we do. You know what
I'm saying? I'm sorry, your hometown doesn't have any pride.
That's, yeah.
Is she from San Diego?
Totally possible. Maybe Santa Clarita.
All right, sir. Thank you for doing this. Hey, I appreciate
man,
it.
That was great to be.
Yeah,
thanks,
we can sit here and talk forever.
Wait, yeah, yeah.
One thing I'm gonna do right now is go track my ballot because I feel sort of scared now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, too late, bro.
Oh yeah. David Diggs always with the truth.
David Diggs is an actor, director, writer, and rapper. He's the MC for the hip-hop group Clipping, which recently released its fourth album, Visions of Bodies Being Burned.
You can see him in The Good Lord Bird on Showtime, and the TV series that continues the story of Blindspotting will come out on Stars. Also, check him out in the new viral hit, Puppy for Hanukkah, which you can check out on YouTube.
As we say every week, we love hearing your reactions to our conversations on Politically Reactive.
And sometimes we like to share the messages we get.
Hi, Hari and Kamau. I just have to tell you that I am so, so, so happy that you are back. I just listened to your interview with Latasha Brown, and anytime I hear her interviewed, I am equally fired up, and I just can't tell you how much I value both of your voices and your contributions to just getting us all a little bit of a release and a laugh and then getting us fired up to take action. I just thank you so very, very much. I work on the COVID unit and at my hospital, and things are really dark right now and getting scarier, and just shows like yours really, really, really give me life. So I just can't thank you enough. Also, just appreciate how you two are in the world and with each other, and this the genuine affection that you show each other, and this, and then also you just are just so cute dads. And I'm just so glad to know you in this way. And I hope all is well with you and your families. And I don't know. I just love you guys. I'm rambling. Bye.
That like made my week. That is so nice. And especially someone who like works at the COVID unit. Like, this is why we came back.
I certainly know from United States of America that people can really take you into their heart in a way when you do this kind of stuff. And so I think it's but that's why I always respect when people tell you that, because you know they don't have to. She didn't have to call. She didn't have to reach out to us.
It feels like she's friends with us even though we don't know her, because there's so much love there. And the fact that she sees the dynamic that we have with each other and how we put our personal lives out there, and there's genuine love and affection that we have in addition to like a genuine curiosity about the world. And it's just, for my own sanity, I'm going to assume that every single one of our listeners is like this.
That's one way to go.
I mean, because I've met enough, you know, when I used to do stand-up comedy professionally, you know, people would come up to me and they would talk about Politically Reactive, but it's how they talked about Politically Reactive. It isn't just I missed the podcast. Mm-hmm. It was why it meant something to them. And that encapsulated, I think, probably what a lot of people felt when they would talk to us about the podcast. We're doing good work, Kamau.
Well, yeah, I think that's the person I came back for. I mean, right. It was people like that who would say they missed the podcast. Not like in like, I kind of miss it, but in like, it was doing something for me that nothing else is doing. So I really appreciate you, Jen. Thank you for doing your work.
Absolutely, Jen.
Thank you, Jen.
Be safe.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Thanks again to our friend, the legendary David Diggs.
Thanks to Sub Pop Records from my favorite city, Seattle, for making music from David Diggs' group Clipping available for the show. We always want to hear your reactions to the conversations we're having on Politically Reactive. Please keep tweeting and Facebooking us your comments and questions using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive.
Or, like Jen, you can leave us a message at 917-477-6525, 917-477-6525.
We're going to go on a little bit of a break, but we promise we'll come back. I know we've said that before, but we mean it this time. We'll be back in 2021. But if you have time to kill, the Kundabolu Brothers podcast has released a new episode, which means that's 31 episodes in a decade. So each one very special and
locally sourced.
No idea when the next one's dropping after, but I will say, listening to the archive the other day, it's still an incredibly funny, weird podcast with my brother Ashok, and Kamau's been on it a few times. And so if you have some time while you're missing us, you can tune into the Kundabolu Brothers podcast.
And also, we're always trying to support the Georgia runoff. That's January 5th is the date of the official date of the election, but I think there's early voting in Georgia now. But if you're not in Georgia, then you can support by going to FairFight or GASenate.com, or as we talked to last week, Latasha Brown, you can go to Black Voters Matter. You can send money. You can volunteer through phone banking or text banking, or you can just call all your people in Georgia, make sure they're going
to
vote.
And if you're still on the fence about what to do with Georgia, listen to our last episode with Latasha Brown, and then you'll do something. Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. The executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And me, W. Kamau Bell.
And me, America's number one dad, Hari Kundabolu.
Nope.
The show is produced by Matt Martin, Malachi Seeger Sakir, and Kelly Rafferty. Will Staten engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
Happy New Year, everybody.